Hello and welcome to the Scottish Clans. This is Clint. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to have you for this conversation I had with Dr. Martin McGregor. This was such an enjoyable experience for me. I got so much out of it. I let him do most of the talking, and he just really gave us a feast of information, specifically about the Campbells and the McGregors, where they came from, their rise, their interaction with each other, and how that went. It was very turbulent history, but there's a lot more to it than what you read in a Wikipedia article, and boy, are you going to be able to dive into it today. So thank you for tuning into this. Before I hand you over to my conversation with Dr. McGregor that I enjoyed so much, I do want to just mention a couple details. I know that it has been a long time since the last episode. I am sorry, Fred Ellis. That was so cool that you would reach out to me and say, hey, what happened? You still there? No, here's what happened, everybody. We moved. So, after selling a home farther south from here and moving back up to northern Utah, we weren't ready to engage in the real estate market because it's kind of crazy right now, and we're not ready to pay $500,000 for a mediocre property. So, we decided to rent. Well, we had a good rental, but our landlord was needing to free up some capital, and so he's going to need to sell that place, and so we needed to find someplace else. And guess what? We've been so blessed. We have got another awesome spot with a really cool view of the mountains, and we're just really liking it. So, but that has taken up a lot of my energy, and time and effort, and so the podcast got kicked to the side for a little bit. So I apologize for those of you who've been kept waiting, like Fred, who reached out about it. Thank you so much. Also, just as a put in a kind plug for Fred, if he was bragging on the New Hampshire Highland Games. So if you live in New England, I've never been there to them, but he was saying they're pretty cool. So if you live in New England or you want to travel to New England, then just do a Google search for the new Highland Games of New Hampshire and go check that out. So thanks, Fred, for reaching out. I do have another couple of shout-outs to give to you, the people who've reached out. I love that about this project, that I get to interact with awesome people. James Loftus, he is actually a published author. He's got a book series called Celtic Blood, and James, I haven't got to that yet. Like I said, I've had a lot on my plate lately, but that sounds really interesting. I think it's so cool that I have somebody who's written books and has it out there for the world on Amazon. That you are part of the audience. So thank you so much for reaching out to me. And also to Caleb Rice, yes, I do speaking engagements. So let's discuss some details, brother. Anyway, and one more thing before I hand you over to my discussion with Dr. McGregor, I do have a YouTube channel. And it's called the same thing as has the same name as the podcast, Scottish Clans. And if you go there and find the channel called Scottish Clans, I have a lot of this content that is on here, I have put over there and added visual aids to it, because I know how, as a guy who has been a professional teacher for so long, visual aids are so powerful. And so if you don't have a map of Scotland memorized, or you don't know what these places look like photos of landscape and things like that, or objects that we're discussing, like when we discussed the fairy flag of the MacLeods, you know, there's pictures of stuff out there. And so I include visual aids on the YouTube channel. So feel free to go over there and check out some of my content. Yes, my last episode with Dr. Anus McConaughey that we talked about, he taught us a ton of stuff about the MacLeods and the Mackenzies. So in this episode, we're getting a different professor, similar structure, different clans. So I just feel so blessed to be able to interact with these professors that have been so kind with their time and shared what they know with us. But that was a really cool experience. A lot of that content, ladies and gentlemen, is going to the YouTube channel. So if you're listening to this immediately after I publish it, it might not be up there yet. But if you're listening to this down the road, go over and check out that. Like I said, now YouTube's getting a lot more of my effort than it has in the past. And so I'll have smaller chunks as well as the long form, just dropping the whole conversation on there with Dr. Anus McConaughey. That's priority number one. Then I'll start working on this episode that you're hearing right now with Dr. McGregor. We'll start chopping that down, adding visual aids, putting that on YouTube. And then eventually, and there's a little preview for the future, I have another interview that I've already recorded. So I've got three Scottish professors. Another interview, I'm not going to tell you who it is yet, but there's one locked and loaded. I just need to, now that we're settled into our new home, get get settled in and get that in a published format. So stay tuned for some awesome stuff coming in the future, as well as more cool stories. Guys, this takes time. It takes effort. If you find this valuable at all, I encourage you to go to scottish-clans.com/team, and there you can contribute to the cause. There's a QR code, so you can just drop some, like a one-time donation in there. Even just a little bit helps a ton. If it's like the cost of a drink, buy me a drink. Or if you want to become a subscriber, go over to that. I've got a link on scottish-clans.com/team. It'll send you right over to Patreon, and you can become a subscriber and make it regular. Even if it's a very small amount, like I said, it still adds up and it's still helpful. Whether it's the price of a drink or you want to actually buy me the cost of a book. Yes, I do buy books, and a lot of my content has come from some of those books I've got off of Amazon. So there's one way you can contribute. And with all those things that I just mentioned, I will now, you've been waiting so patiently, I'll hand you over to my conversation with Dr. Martin McGregor. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Scottish Clans. I'm Clint with the Scottish Clans podcast, and we have Dr. Martin McGregor of Glasgow University with us today. I'm so thankful that he decided to come on and have this discussion. I am really excited to hear what he has to say and to learn as somebody who, that's his profession. That's what he does for a living. He researches and then shares that research with other people. And I will have Dr. McGregor here give us a little background on his background, give us a little bit of who he is, an introduction to him. And then we'll dive into talking about the Campbells and the McGregors. But I do want my audience to know the indebtedness that I do have to Martin here with, I was writing my master's thesis and I was living very remotely. And so it was all online and I just didn't have access to a lot of sources. And I had a really hard time finding the academic stuff, the scholarly work. And I can't remember how I found your name, but you were one of three professors, the others being Anis McConaughey and Ali Cathcart. But Martin's response was so genuine, so helpful, just meek in his approach to, I just want to help other people understand. So he shared some things with me. I said, how do I get past this Google search level that I'm on? And he shared some of his own writings, pointed me in the direction of other sources. And I really think that I was able to go through that and be successful in that endeavor with writing that master's thesis because in large part for Martin's help. So I want to acknowledge that and give you that gratitude in front of my audience. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute here. Will you share with us just some brief highlights of your background and maybe how you got to be interested in studying what you're doing now?
I'll do that, Clint. And first of all, many thanks for inviting me onto the podcast. It's a great pleasure to be here. And just as I tried to help yourself at that time, we always see things like this as opportunities to share knowledge. There's no point in being an academe if you're kind of possessive and jealous about what you may know. It's all about communication. And it's great that we've got these kind of different levels of communication, different means of communication available to us now. So to all your audience out there, it's a great pleasure for me to be in your company, hoping I can share some knowledge that I've been able to acquire over the years. I guess many of these things come back to family with us, the influences upon us. And in my own case, my father's people are obviously McGregors. They were always the side of the family that we knew less about, actually, and the kind of connection to the Highlands had kind of lessened there. My father grew up in Edinburgh, and that's where we grew up as well. So my knowledge of the family tree on that side of the family is sketchy. And on the other side, my mother's side, it's different. She's a MacDonald from the Western Isles of Scotland, from North Uist, and is a Gaelic speaker. And as many of you will know, Gaelic, at one time very, very widely spoken in Scotland, is now in a pretty precarious situation. But where my mother came from, the Western Isles, is a kind of great bastion of Gaelic speech. We didn't grow up Gaelic speaking, but it was there The knowledge of it was there and access to it was there. And I guess there was an element of trying to reclaim my roots as I grew up in terms of making serious efforts to learn Gaelic. And that combined with academic interests in history, which began to move towards Scottish history. And then the two things, I think, coalesced in terms of an interest in Highland history, if you want to call it that, history of the Gaelic speakers in Scotland, perhaps another way of putting it. And when I got the chance to go on and do a PhD at Edinburgh University, I was kind of pretty clear at that stage that was the terrain I wanted to study, to look at Gaelic speaking society in Scotland. But I have to say that the subject of my doctoral research, which was the history of one of the clans we're going to be mainly talking about, well, both of them come into this story. They're inextricably interlinked, really, their histories. It was my own father's people, the MacGregors. And that was really the brainchild of my supervisor, Dr. John Bannerman, who was a huge influence upon me and exceptionally knowledgeable in this field. And it was really he who steered me towards this topic. And much of that was to do with the fact that the history of clans, serious study of clans in Scotland, is very, very poorly developed. And one has to say that still remains the case, although things are better than they were. But we don't have, you know, I would say still a really developed knowledge of the clan, of clan society in general, or particular clans. But John's idea was that the MacGregors would be a great case study because their history was so dramatic, really. Essentially what happened was that in 1603, James VI and First, 6th of Scotland and 1st of England, took sufficient umbrage with the MacGregors that he proscribed the clan. He actually seeked to wipe them off the map in every sense, including eliminating the name. And although it proved very difficult to do that, and I guess that's one of the things we might touch on in this podcast, just the difficulty of actually eradicating a clan once they come into being, there was plenty of repression in the period after 1603. So John's idea was that if one could study that, study how the MacGregors managed to retain a clan identity despite everything that was thrown at them, then you would get really precious insights into clan society. That was a very well-founded idea, but my first thought was, okay, I need to work out what was going on before then, before 1603. So I went back to look at the origins and just try and trace things from there. And in the event, my kind of thesis study and my doctoral research didn't really seriously get beyond 1570 or so. I found enough stuff actually to be able to draw a line there, and it was quite a kind of clear line in the sand as well. So that's the kind of, as it were, the personal background, Clint, and just how that led me to this place. I was lucky enough to get a lectureship in Scottish history in 1995, and that's allowed me to continue study of these themes since then. And very often that's been profoundly shaped by the students whom I have the great good fortune to teach. You know, I think research and teaching, these two things, there's always a very symbiotic relationship between them.
I agree. I spent about 14 years as a teacher, and it is interesting the degree to which it brings your level of knowledge up, having to articulate that, and then the give and take between you and the students, and how that really helps the whole subject to flesh out. Now, you said you were interested in the MacGregors. Your intent was to get in there from the prescription of the MacGregors on. You went to get the background of it, and that's just where you ended up hanging out, was in the background. And I will tell everybody, my audience who has been with me for a while, has heard me mention your PhD thesis, which I must say, and I have a few writings of yours. I actually did go all the way through it at one time. And recently, that was a few years ago, but recently I went back into it because I can't remember why, but I was trying to get back into the MacGregor origins, especially where this whole, you know, Sheil Alpin idea, and you had some really interesting hypotheses about where the Alpin, like probably not Kenneth MacAlpin and not that Alpin grew, but another MacAlpin kindred, possibly.
Yeah. Yes.
And I did want to throw in there, they were prescribed for the straw that broke the camel's back for the government was the Battle of Glenfruin, correct?
That's correct, yes, for sure.
So this is where we're connected, me and you, is because I have McFarlane ancestry.
Ah, yes.
Uh-huh. And I don't know how it's told on the McGregor side of it, but on the McFarlane side of it, we're like, yeah, we were there. There's a bunch of us in there. And somehow you guys took the hit. Your name was on it.
Yeah, well, there may be various reasons for that, but that's very interesting to hear about your McFarlane ancestry. And I think McFarlanes are perhaps one of these clans which is kind of neglected and which could really do with study. And the part of the world from which they hail, the Lennox, as we call it, one of the historic earldoms of Scotland, one of these kind of major divisions, kind of regional provinces, if you like, of Scotland. A very, very interesting area with a grouping of clans there, all with obviously connected histories. And it's an area that came into my thesis a bit, and there seemed to have been, on the whole, I would say, pretty cordial relationships between the MacGregors and MacFarlanes. One of the really interesting things about the MacGregor story, both before and after 1603, before and after the prescription, is the fact that very often when they were in extreme circumstances, they had to rely on society at large, if you want to put it that way, for very basic support, you know, in terms of providing the fundamentals of life to keep them going. And the MacFarlanes seem to be one of those clans who kind of acted in that capacity. Now, there could be political reasons for that at certain periods, and I think there were, but it seems to have been a pretty good relationship, I would say.
I think so, and I think that in various motivations or incentives to be hospitable, to extend that and cultivate that relationship in a time of need for the MacGregors, I don't think that more than one motivations are mutually exclusive. There could have been politics. There could have been an actual relationship between the two that was beyond politics. I don't know, but I agree. It's an area that I would love to dive into. When you say this was not a planned part of our conversation, but you just mentioned that represents kind of that area, that geographical area, the Lennox. There's kind of a cluster of clans. Aside from the MacFarlanes, what others would you be referring to there?
Yeah, well, this is the part of the world, you know, I guess many people will have heard of Loch Lomond, one of Scotland's most famous and most scenic lochs. And it's, in geological terms, it's a very interesting part of Scotland because the physical Highland boundary fault, the geological feature which is distinguishes highlands from lowlands in geological terms, it runs right through Loch Lomond on a kind of north east to southwest axis. And so in some ways you've got a kind of almost a microcosm of Scotland in that area, but you've got the MacFarlanes there. There's the Cahoons of Luss, or another Lennox kindred, the Macaulays of Ardencapel, they're perhaps one hears less about, the Buchanans, another major kindred in that part of the world. So you do have this cluster, and no one's really kind of studied these various clans of the Lennox, you know, in their own right, I would say. The Galbraiths, I should have mentioned, that's another one. Their name has been anglicised over time, so you kind of lose the sense of the kind of Gaelic origins. But Galbraith is properly in Gaelic, Mach Gevrechtenich, which means literally son of the Briton man, Briton. In other words, somebody who was of the Britons, of that particular people, who effectively we might say were the Welsh, actually, in terms of their origins, Brittonic speaking people, that particular branch of the Celtic languages. So this cluster of clans, and it looks likely that they all take us back to the ruling lineage of the Earldom of Lennox. There, the Lennox was an earldom And this seems to actually have been one of the ways in which clans could come into being, that where you had these earls in place on the map in Scotland, ruling over a particular part of the country as the kind of chief secular lords beneath the crown. That as the as that family, the ruling family of the earldom, spread and grew over time, throwing out shoots, that some of these could become kindreds in their own right. And even if the earldom itself went down the kind of main line and ceased to function properly, you have this kind of permanent legacy on the map in terms of a group of kindreds. And one can see that pattern in other parts of Scotland as well, but the Lennox is a really good example.
Thank you for unpacking that a little bit. And it was there right at the end, it was making me think, well, I was like, well, yes, the MacFarlanes are a junior branch of that original family, the Earl of Lennox. But going back into your thesis on the MacGregors, and maybe this is a good opportunity to maybe to go back, maybe discuss a little bit about the origins of the MacGregors, a little bit about the origins of the Campbells, and then and their rise and come to prominence, and then their interaction with each other and where it went from there. But if I recall correctly in your thesis, just as the MacFarlanes were a junior branch of the Earls of Lennox, I know that as time goes on, our ideas and understandings evolve. Is it still maybe a thesis or a possibility in your head that the MacGregors were a junior line? This you actually put forward in your thesis a few different ideas. Yeah. You didn't seem married to any one of them, but possibly the MacGregors being a junior line of the MacAlpins who were in power in that area of Glenstrae.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a contentious area, and I think it's always complicated by the fact that Gaelic genealogies didn't just exist as kind of biological statements, you know, statements of biological fact. This was a society where kinship really mattered, and in a sense, almost paradoxically, that could result in the manipulation of descents in order to create, you know, more illustrious origins. But that's really just a sign that kinship really mattered, and that this was a way of demonstrating your importance in society, and perhaps how that was changing over time, and how your political allegiance was changing over time, and whether you were dependent on someone else or trying to cut a figure for yourself on the historical stage. So manipulation of genealogies is just part and parcel of the scene. So that complicates life for the historian. And what the MacGregors said about themselves in the later Middle Ages, when we can get a fix on their own take on this, as opposed to what others, you know, were saying about their origins, was that they had this royal descent, and we can see this, we can trace this idea as far back as the later 15th century, and then it's pretty prevalent in the 16th. And the way that they justified this royal descent, or, you know, what they based it upon, was an apparent connection, a supposed connection to a figure, Alpin, who appears in the, as it were, the version of the genealogy which we can call a MacGregor version of things, and it's quite clear from the, as it were, the contextual material that they're trying to present this guy as the Alpin, famous in Scottish history, as father of Kenneth MacAlpin, often seen as a kind of founder father of the prototype Scottish kingdom itself, and that's taking you back to the middle of the 9th century. I mean, my take on this was that this was unlikely to be, you know, we shouldn't accept this at face value, but what could have been happening was that MacGregor ancestors, one of whom bore a name which resembled that of Kenneth, another one whose name may well have been Alpin, that they were being, you know, perhaps understandably, identified with those historical figures, and this would of course give you a connection with the royal lineage itself, and it would be a way of emphasizing high status or kind of rising political status on your part, and perhaps a way too of demonstrating political independence. This seemed to me to be maybe part and parcel of it, that this was saying, no, we're not connected to the MacDonald Lordship of the Isles, we're not to be seen as some kind of offshoot of the Campbells per se, that we have our own identity. So that was my take on the kind of the, as it were, the deeper origins of the MacGregors. That's the kind of best I could do in this. I mean, other versions of the MacGregor genealogy exist. There's a compilation of manuscripts of genealogies, which we can connect to the MacDonald, the famous MacDonald Lords of the Isles, of later medieval Scotland. And there the MacGregors are kind of tied up with everybody else as going back to an origin in the early Gaelic kingdom of Dalriada, basically equivalent to Argyll in modern Western Scotland. So that's a totally different descent altogether from these names which are being equated with Kenneth and Alpin. But as I say, that Kenneth Alpin descent, that seems to be the one that the MacGregors themselves, once we get sources that allow us to get a line on the MacGregor view of matters, that seems to be the one that they favoured.
And that is even reflected in their motto, which in Gaelic sounds like,
"Well, Sriel Magraum is the motto that's come down to us. Royal is my race." And sometimes I think people think that this is all the things to do, like mottos, etc. This is all part of the colourful history of the clans, but really to be ascribed to the age of romanticism as opposed to the age of the clans proper, and that everything becomes as it were catalogable, and everyone's got their own particular tartan and their own motto, and all of this is maybe more to do with the world of Walter Scott. But we can trace ideas such as this back into the later Middle Ages. I don't think that we should be kind of too dismissive of all of these ideas. And there's an interesting poem which comes from the Campbell side, later 16th century. And by this point in time, the Campbells and the MacGregors had fallen out, so it's a hostile source. But it talks about the MacGregor arms, the coat of arms, with the fir tree and the sword crossed below a crown. And the way in which it talks, it's clearly acceptant of the fact that this is what the MacGregors say about their origins, about this royal origin. I think sometimes it can be very easy as an historian to, especially with a subject like the clans, which have been very romanticized, to become almost too cynical, too hard bitten, too dismissive. And I think as an historian, you just have to avoid that. You really got to try and keep your mind open all of the time, and just try and treat the evidence on its merits.
I love that. I love that idea. So the symbols used by the MacGregors, go back, when was that time period that you just referred to, where you see that pop up in Campbell literature?
Yeah, that's the later 16th century, that point to talk about there. And it's also evident in, I can think of one source that historians of medieval and late medieval times can use, are seals, the seals that would be appended to documents in order to authenticate them. They really go back, perhaps, particularly to a time before people were literate, before lay society was a literate society, and before people could sign a document as a means of authenticating it, you would have a seal made out of wax, which could do that for you. And then that could bear not just your name, perhaps, but it could bear iconography as well. And we have a MacGregor seal from the later 16th century. Interestingly, it's not the seal related to a particular chief. You might have thought it would come from the very top, but it's a branch of the MacGregors who very, very interestingly became established in the town of Perth in the 16th century. And we would think of that as perhaps unusual, because that's crossing the Highland-Lowland line. There they are functioning in a borough, as we call them in Scotland, a trading town. Perth was a very important trading town on the east coast of Scotland, trading across to Scandinavia and to the Baltic region, to northern continental Europe. But this individual and the branch of the MacGregors to which he belonged, they clearly had no problem in doing this. They didn't require a passport to kind of go across the Highland line and to establish themselves in this trading context in a lowland borough. But the fact that he had a seal which bore these emblems, is suggestive of the fact that they certainly didn't forget, you know, the where they came from and the clan to which they belonged.
This is that makes me think of a broader clan question, but so these MacGregors that were established in Perth, to what degree would they have maintained that? Like Bannerman likes to use the term kin-based society. Would yes. they have continued to participate in that with that geographical dislocation there?
They did. I mean, there's clear evidence about this, and I got very interested in these people, I must say, because they are, you know, it's the kind of thing that you come across in the sources and perhaps didn't expect to find, because it kind of bucks the trend, it bucks the neat boxes that we sometimes fix in our minds, you know, kind of compartmentalizing history as a means of understanding it. But they were kind of going counter to a number of standard narratives. And it was quite clear that they maintained close connections with their kinsfolk not far away to the west in Highland, Perthshire. And one interesting aspect to note about them is that it looks like the first of them who became established seriously in Perth bore the forename, the personal name, John in Gaelic, Eoin. They started to develop them to use the in a lowland context, in a non-Gaelic context, the surname Johnston, which made sense and kind of pointed to the their founder figure, their eponym, as we call them. And so when the prescription came about in 1603, the prescription of the MacGregors, and the name itself was actually banned, you know, one could no longer use the surname MacGregor, things were easy for these particular people. You know, they had already, if you like, developed an alternative which didn't actually, in the eyes of society, I'm sure, obscure the fact that, you know, of their ultimate origin, but it certainly allowed them to continue using that name. There was no name change that was required on their part. So they are a really interesting branch of the MacGregors. And I think one could go further. This is an area that hasn't been properly researched, but looking at the towns of late medieval Scotland, the boroughs, as we call them, and looking for the presence of Gaelic speakers, you know, within the makeup of the boroughs, because I don't think that Perth was unique in this regard, or the MacGregors were the only ones who were doing this. We've got a chain of boroughs around the kind of what came to be the frontier, if we should call it that, between Highlands and Lowlands, you know, going from your part of the world, Clint, from the Lennox kind of area. We think of Dumbarton as the kind of main place there, round to Stirling, and then round to Perth, round to Inverness. And it'd be an interesting project, I think, to do more research on the kind of Gaelic aspect to these places in the later Middle Ages.
That is fascinating, and it is a very murky, I think you're getting into this boundary, like you use the word frontier, and I've actually in my podcast talked about, I started to use the term frontier clans, because border clans is already taken. Yeah. and you can argue, like, you know, about using the word clan or whatever down there, but I mean, but there was a kin-based society on the border, so I thought that one was out. So I had, what's a good word for these clans that wherever their base was, whether it was just in the Highlands or just out of the Highlands in the Lowlands, but their territory straddled this boundary, yes. You would have had an interacting of cultures. Yes. And Drummonds, Ogilvies,
yes. Yes.
Right up along the eastern side. I don't want to stray too far off the topic, but any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that's a great question to ask. And absolutely, you know, that this is something that's understudied, you know, and I would love to do more on this. I mean, one finds some, what does one call them? It's always difficult. One finds some kindreds, perhaps, is an easier word maybe to use, but families always seems to me to be too, maybe it's maybe just not strong enough a term, and you know, I suppose we immediately think of the nuclear family rather than in a bigger structure. But I mean, one example that I'm very interested in, and just have not been studied at all, but they come into the MacGregor Campbell story. These are the Minguses, they're interesting in their origins, as was the case with, you know, many a significant family in Scottish history, Bruce's and the Stuarts, for example, fit into this. But the Mingus's origins were French, Northern French, and they come over, as many of these new Scots did, in the 12th and 13th century. This is all kind of happening in the wake of the conquest, basically, and England becomes a kind of jumping off point for people as they sometimes head north. And the Minguses did that, and they got established in the border region, first of all. But you find them in late medieval Scotland. They're up in Aberdeen, they're down in the southwest, but the ones that I came across are there in the central highlands of Scotland in Perthshire. And in that context, they're clearly functioning as a clan, and they're part of Gaelic society. But that's not true of all of the, as it were, branches of the Mingus kindred in this period. So I think there's more to be done on this, and just on the fact that people are able to get around and to function in a way which, again, perhaps defies the sense of strict boundaries. These MacGregors, these Johnsons, who go to Perth, they're an example of this as well. The Campbells, of course, themselves, another clan which does this very successfully. We find the Campbells establishing branches over in the east of Scotland, north of the Forth Clyde line, over in Angus, and down in Ayrshire as well, in Robert Burns' country. The Campbells of Loudoun are a very, very significant branch of the kindred, and they, just like you were saying about the Johnsons, they maintain connections with, as it were, Campbell headquarters in Argyll. So I think one finds, you know, just a lot of mobility and fluidity going on here. And of course, that, you know, one has to bear this in mind when one is trying to think about the concept or reality of highlands and lowlands in late medieval Scotland.
That same idea came up in my conversation with Ali, that this is, it really is not as tidy as we would like it to be. We want to put everything in our nice little boxes and make it pretty and neat, but it does, it really that's really going to take you off on some bad conclusions, I think, when studying this.
I think the you know, one of the great problems is it's an iconic feature, I suppose, of the Scottish tourist industry, but the clan map of Scotland, when you have a map which divides the country up into the areas of particular clans, and of course what that does, it, I mean, it's not that that doesn't contain elements of truth to it, of course it does, but the danger is that it makes you believe, or makes you think, that this was set in stone from some unspecified point in the deep past, and that no clan was allowed to transgress its own boundaries, and that no other clan could stray into inhabit the bounds of another, you know. So it's I guess that's the ultimate the ultimate kind of symbol of the dangers of being too rigid in one's understanding of the society.
I grew up with one of those. I've had one of those, the Scotland of old, since I was since I was a senior in high school, which is longer ago than I'd like to admit. And and I did really have a very compartmentalized idea of how this was all laid out. And then that led me to, within the last year, I've done a couple, a podcast episode, some short YouTube video or two about what a clan map is good for and what it's not good for.
Yeah, that's excellent.
And I would love, if you ever had a chance, I'd love to have you sharpshoot that and say, like, yeah, you're close, Clint. Anyway, you were talking about, because that in the discussing those kindreds that are engaged on both sides of the line, wherever their headquarters is, they're involved. Going back to that conversation with Ali, the Gordons were their headquarters in the lowlands.
Yep.
But very involved in the Highlands. Yes. And you brought up the Campbells, and maybe that'd be a good opportunity, because as we just, you said, the MacGregors, probably not from Kenneth MacAlpin, but maybe a real Alpin. I have some questions that branch off of that, but that might get us off on a tangent too far. But the MacGregors seem to have, if I read your thesis correctly, come up kind of in tandem through the, as you push on through the 13 into the 1400s and then arrive where you're focusing on. Maybe we could take one step back and jump over to the Campbells now and look at their origins, and then watch these two clans intertwine and how that trajectory went.
Sure. And I mean, it's very helpful that you mentioned the Gordons there, just as part of that, because in some ways you might regard the Campbells and Gordons as kind of mirror images, and the Gordons, you know, as you say, basically rooted in non-Gaelic speaking Scotland in the northeast, but hugely influential across the Highland line, and the Campbells perhaps a mirror image of that, you know, very much rooted in Gaelic society in Argyll, but able to spread their wings further and operate on a truly national basis, and ultimately actually on a broader basis than that. The Campbells, I think, are endlessly fascinating, and you know, one of the things about a clan society which goes against the idea of the fixed map is that the fortunes of kindreds can rise and fall. This is just kind of a natural pattern to observe, and it seems to be really hard to kind of maintain your place at the top, you know, over time. And the startling thing about the Campbells that seems to set them apart from pretty much everybody is that they do that. That whereas others are rising and falling, the essential Campbell trajectory is always upwards for century upon century. In terms of their origins, very interesting as well. I mentioned the Galbraiths earlier, and the surname pointing to an origin in what we call, you know, in what was within early medieval Scotland the Kingdom of Strathclyde. Strathclyde is still the name for the kind of greater Glasgow area, with the river, you know, obviously being the famous River Clyde being the kind of distinguishing feature here. And Strathclyde, we've mentioned Dumbarton as well already, which is a very important borough and strategic point on the Firth of Clyde itself. And Dumbarton was the main. Dumbarton means the Dún Bhriacht, and the fortress of the Britons, and it was the headquarters of a major early medieval kingdom, the Kingdom of Strathclyde. And the people there in that kingdom were, in the first instance, Brittonic or Welsh speaking, and the Campbells seem to come into being. Their genealogies, and again we've got various genealogies, and some of them are, as it were, more biologically accurate than others, some of them are more political, but the ones that really, you know, kind of seem to give us the best line here, they point us to this kingdom, and the names in the genealogy are very, very Brittonic names. But the Campbells, as the clan, became embedded in Gaelic Scotland, became thoroughly Gaelic speaking. As I've said, you know, if you're functioning within this kin-based clan society, your genealogy needs to reflect who you are. So we have other versions of the Campbell genealogy that give them Gaelic credentials, or at least seek to reconcile this genuine British connection with a Gaelic origin as well. You see some very very good work by the Campbells professional genealogists to try and square these circles. That's what these professional genealogists were all about, and the Campbell genealogy is just an outstanding example of that. So that's the kind of background there, quite an interesting one, and pointing to that kingdom. But when we come across them really in terms of you know, the historical sources as opposed to the genealogies, that's already pointing us towards Argyll, and this is the part of the map where the Campbells really rise to prominence, and it becomes the kind of bulwark, if you like, the kind of heartland of the clan. And I mean, to go back to our clan maps and to give them some credit here, this is something that you could say is that for a long period, you know, Argyll is, you know, it becomes Campbell country. That's not to say that there aren't other clans present there. There certainly are, but the Campbells over time build up a tremendous power base in Argyll. And in doing that, they're supplanting a previous clan, the MacDougalls, who had reigned supreme in Argyll in the 12th, 13th, and into the 14th centuries. But their position suffered for various reasons, not least because they took against Robert Bruce in the First Scottish War of Independence right at the start of the 14th century, and that cost them significantly. And that was one of the factors that pushes the Campbells forward. You know, you're always looking at the connection to the crown as one factor that's going to influence the destiny of a clan, and the Campbells from a political point of view, made the right call there, you know, and they came down, you know, on the patriotic side. And that was one of the factors that sets them on this upwards trajectory from the early 14th century onwards.
That they so that I have read some of Stephen Boardman's work where he makes a pretty good argument to your point of a Brythonic, the Strathclyde Britons, their origin yes. laying somewhere there genetically probably, and then and he says that their early power base is a little farther south than Argyll. Yep. And now when you talk about bringing some Gaelic roots into this, are you talking about this Oduinia? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that exactly correctly, yes. where that element comes back into that. Do you, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, this is an ancestor figure called Duivne. Duivne, so you're bang on with your pronunciation there. And this looks like, again, this could be a case of, you know, there's a figure within Gaelic mythology, if you want to call it that, you know, who bears this name. And it looks like it's in exactly the same case as what the MacGregors were doing with inverted commas, Kenneth and Alpin, of identifying genuine figures in their genealogy with other, you know, figures, illustrious figures. And in that case, Duivne gave the Campbells a Gaelic connection, and that this became Uduivne became one of the ways by which you could refer to the chief of the Campbells. We often think of the chief of the Campbells as equivalent to the Earl of Argyll, because that was the main office, if you like, the main title that the chiefs of the Campbells came to hold in late medieval Scotland. But in Gaelic society, it wouldn't be really meaningful to. I mean, you could easily talk about the particular Earl of Argyll, you know, in Gaelic, using that title. But it wasn't really the way that you did it. It would always be the what we call the style of the chief, and say in the case of the MacGregor chief, that would simply be MacGregor, and so that's the, as it were, the surname form. But when you used it of a chief, that was different. Technically, that was different. That was the style of a chief. MacGregor, you know, and there was only one individual who could bear that name being used as a style. And Uduivne was used of the chief of the Campbells. And when it was used of the chief, it was always in a kind of antiquarian context, a very learned context. It was quite a, you know, a sort of high cultural statement to make. The statement that the style that was more commonly used in the later Middle Ages from a figure who was more recent within the Campbell genealogy was Mac Callain, or sometimes Mac Callain Mór, and that was that's probably the main style of the chief of the Campbells. So the genealogy is very interesting, and just to conclude on that, it's interesting to note that apart from having a Brythonic descent and then this Gaelic descent, a kind of late manifestation of the way the Campbells were moving was the fact that they also added a Norman dimension to their. Yeah. To their origins. So you've got kind of three potential origins. And this, I think, was all really to do with the fact that as time goes on, and especially when we get to the era of the Reformation in England and Scotland, and the potential for exporting that Reformation to Ireland as well, you know, so we get a kind of a genuinely kind of British and archipelagic kind of context, you know, when you need to think in these terms. And the Campbells did think in these terms. Their ambitions were in no way confined to Gaelic Scotland or to Argyll. And this Norman dimension, I think, was part of their kind of learned, this was using their genealogy to try and again kind of stake a claim to wider Campbell ambitions. And that's really coming, moving into the early modern period, I would say, into the 17th century.
So you're referring to specifically that Campo Bello, which has probably about as much historical historical quality as the Colin Fitzgerald for the Mackenzies.
For the Mackenzies, that's right. I think as you go on in time, one notices that, you know, I mentioned these professional genealogists who would be operative within a Gaelic context, and they were very skillful in what they did, and they also recognised that there were parameters. It wasn't just a case that you could make stuff up, as it were, or if you were making it up, it was according to set rules. So that kind of prevented them from doing just anything, as it were, from really outlandish stuff. And you can see that they weren't too impressed by some of these newfangled ideas that were coming in to do with the Campbells and the Campobello idea. But it's interesting to note, as the Campbells move more and more into that kind of British sphere, that one thing that they become strongly associated with in terms of perceptions of their past was Arthurianism as well. This idea that, and this of course takes you back to the British thing, the British origin, and the fact that we do have within the Campbell genealogy that genuine, as it were, early Brittonic genealogy. Arthur occurs as a name. And we don't need to kind of assume that that's the King Arthur of legend. But as time goes on, the association is inevitably made as the Campbells' ambitions begin to become ever more British. That was just a natural thing that was going to happen.
So that's a good explanation of that. Was the O'Duigne connection? Was that then a female line? Did they marry into this and become heirs through a female line and adopt that name? Because you see that with in other counterparts, like the Seatons become Gordons in order to inherit the Earldom of Huntly. And then the Gordons, a junior branch of them, and it's kind of this domino effect. They go up to Sutherland and through a female line and inherit that. Do you suspect that that was something like that going on here?
I'm not sure in the case of Duivna if that was the case or not. You know, that's a good hypothesis. But you raise an important point there, you know, because I think one of the issues is that when we think of the clans, the clan society, you know, one can become very, very obsessed with the idea. You know, it seems to be very, very male focused, this whole society, you know, very, very patriarchal in terms of its structures. And of course, there's a fundamental truth here. But just because women aren't appearing in the genealogies that have come down to us in the main, doesn't mean that they aren't playing a significant role in society. Within this kin-based society, they are the ones, after all, who are doing the childbearing. And I think this is if we are thinking of an agenda for the future in terms of, you know, what clan studies need to do. I think certainly for Scotland, we need more work on the importance of women and the role of women within the within clan society. And you're quite right to say that sometimes it's through the female connection that clans can come into the possession of fresh territory, and that can result in the creation of branches, you know, fresh branches of a clan. One should never forget, for example, that it was through the female line, that through marriage, that the MacDonalds inherited the Earldom of Ross in the 15th century, and this was a huge expanse of Northern Scotland, and it became a flashpoint as well, because the Crown wasn't too happy about this, so it became disputed territory. But the MacDonalds, you know, as far as they were concerned, they had inherited this in a legitimate manner through the female line, and they were determined that they were going to make that connection good.
Yeah, weren't both competing claims to the Earldom of Ross through the female line? Both of them.
That's right. Exactly so. Yeah. And I think this comes into the MacGregor story as well, because my reading of we talked about their deeper origins, but when you get to the 14th century, and it seems to be at the end of the 14th century that we can really see this clan that we now call the MacGregors coming into being. And it looks like what happens there is that we have the lineage to which they belong. It looks like it ends in an heiress who is legitimate, and therefore the question of, you know, whom she marries becomes a matter of great importance. But it looks like there is also a son who is presumably not legitimate, not in a position to succeed to the territory, and so she marries a Campbell. This is the best hypothesis I could come up with to explain the evidence, as it were, and so these lands, Glenorchy, that estate, if you like, that lordship, passes to the Campbells, but through the son, the one who could not succeed, We have a continuation of the clan itself, the kindred, which up to this point had been in charge of that lordship. And these are the MacGregors. And therefore, we end up with a scenario where we have the lordship of Glenorchy, the title to that, the legal ownership, if you like, rests with the Campbells. But on the ground, the main clan that we have is the clan that comes to be called the MacGregors. So that then kind of creates a very interesting scenario. And this is where, I think, as you know, Clint, my kind of reading of the kind of relationship between these clans differs with, you know, what had been the orthodoxy down to that point.
Absolutely. And so that'd be a great place to go as we see these two clans start to connect. You have this lordship that the Loch Awe branch of the Campbells have extends possibly through marriage of an heiress into Glenorchy then with a junior branch of that legitimate kindred that's on, like you said, on the ground. Now, but it doesn't start off, it doesn't seem like this relationship. First of all, let me get this straight in my head. Is it mostly between the Glenorchy Campbells, because there's so many branches of them, and they almost become like their own clans, yet they remain to a better degree than, for instance, the MacDonalds did, that cohesive unit acknowledging Argyle. It didn't help the MacDonalds that the Lordship of the Isles was forfeited, and that probably had a lot to do with their disunity. But the Campbells, these various branches that are significant in their own right, in their localities, it's this meeting between Campbell and MacGregor happens mostly with this Glenorchy branch, correct?
This is correct, yeah. And I mean, you're very right in what you say there about, and this is, I think, a fascinating thing about clan structure, is that clans can both be, you know, kind of, as it were, large-scale cohesive units, but they can also spawn particular branches, you know, sub-clans, if you want to call them that, or, you know, clans in their own right, which nevertheless acknowledge their place within the greater clan. And I think the MacDonalds, you know, for a long time, the MacDonalds do this well, you know, for a couple of centuries while they're expanding, and they are the Lords of the Isles, their main line is the Lords of the Isles, they retain that cohesion. And what happens then is that in the 1490s, they're forfeited by the Crown, but the Crown was simply taking advantage of internal dissension within the ruling lineage between the father, the then Lord of the Isles, and his son. There's clear evidence of a major split there. And if that happened within a clan, then there was a real danger that you're losing the glue, as it were, that holds everything together. And so the various elements can fracture. So that happens with the MacDonalds, really, after circa 1500. Campbells, they kind of never lose that cohesion, however far flung the various branches go. And the MacGregors, as I've said, you know, their history is kind of remarkable for the fact that, despite the fact that they spread all over the map, then that they get proscribed as well, you know, which kind of just adds to the picture that they seem to manage to retain this. I guess what we take away from this is the fact that clans were remarkably, you know, essentially there's a really, really powerful cohesion about them, and it was really kind of hard to eliminate them, you know, that this connection, you know, is just really, really fundamental. This blood connection, whether real or imagined, in a sense, is immaterial, I think, is fundamental. But to get back to the Glenorchy scenario, I think that's exactly right. Essentially, what we have, if we think of it in landowning terms, is that the Earl of Argyll himself, as he becomes the head of the Campbells, the Campbell of Loch Awe, as he was at this time, as you quite rightly say, he has the lordship of Glenorchy, the superiority, if you want to put it in terms of Scots law. So he's the ultimate landowner beneath the king. He gives part of that lordship to one of his sons, and that son becomes the first of the Campbells of Glenorchy. And as you say, they become a significant branch of the Campbells in their own right. So they're there on the ground. Beside them on the ground are the MacGregors still. They've not gone away. And there was actually a third smaller clan, the MacLachlans, who we know were initially there as well. So it's quite a complex picture that you can get, you know, within a clan society. And there's just this interesting relationship with with Scots law. I think sometimes people think of clan society as almost some kind of tribal thing, you know, and that law, you know, didn't really come into it at all. But all of these clans, it's important to note, are operating within the law of Scotland, the common law of Scotland, and the system of land conveyancing and land owning, which was governed by that law. So that's it. We've got a kind of, you know, a kind of classic feudal pyramid, if you like, with the chief of the Campbells at the top, and then we've got below him these three clans sitting side by side, and then it all comes down to the dynamics of these relationships.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed part one of my discussion with Dr. Martin McGregor. This was a feast for me. I enjoyed this so much, and there is more. Like I said, that was part one. I'm going to do a part two. That's just a lot of content for one episode, so we're going to break that in half. And if you're listening to this and the part two isn't published, it will be really soon. I intend to not drag this out and make them like regular intervals of episodes. I intend to just publish these very close together, and then we'll work on the next episode after that. But yes, please, if the other one's published by the time you get to this point right here, hop right over and continue feasting on this information. Not only is this useful information about the Campbells and McGregors, but it's also, I think, a lot of the things that Dr. McGregor is teaching us here, a lot of these things apply to the kin-based society in general. So, you know, and I'd encourage you to pick something in here that resonates with you, or that you thought was interesting. You've never thought of that before, or he explained it in a way we've never come at it. It's a new angle for you. Or, wow, I never knew that about the Campbells or the McGregors, or about Scottish clans, or about Scottish history. What was it that you found useful in here to know? And share that with me. Like I said at the beginning, I really love to hear you guys' feedback. Were there additional questions? What did I not ask that you really hoped that I would ask? Please reach out to me, thescottishclans@gmail.com is the email. Like I mentioned at the beginning, yes, I do public speaking, speaking engagements. If you've got events, Scottish games coming up, all that, reach out to me and we'll get something lined up. I've got, I just gave you the email. That's probably the best way. Also, remember to go check out the YouTube channel for some of the similar content, but with visual aids. And I will wrap that up, and hopefully you enjoy part two as much as you enjoyed part one.